Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from our studio in East County. The weather this week is wet and wild, with flash flood warnings in effect, so stay tuned for the latest details. Then from Public News Service, we'll have some top national stories, including a poll on who the public blames for the federal government shutdown and impacts as the longest shutdown in our nation's history drags on, as well as news about a trial of activists for helping undocumented immigrants with humanitarian aid in Arizona. In local news, we have a special report about the findings of an independent investigation into a white La Mesa police officer's use of force against a handcuffed African-American female student at Helix High School last January, and frustrations over that report voiced by some members of the City Council and the public. Hear what actions the Council may take next on today's show. After repeated reports of flooding along Highway 94 in Jamul, including a recent episode that left several cars stranded in 4 feet of rushing waters, we reached out to state authorities. Hear what Caltrans has to say on today's show. From Public News Service, learn what California Governor Gavin Newsom's budget has included to expand health care. And then on Green Scene, hear about climate data sites that have gone dark due to the federal shutdown. On our Arts and Music segment, hear about the Mission Trails concert series, which starts up this month in a new location. On Crime Beat, the sheriff is asking public help to locate a man who tried to lure a 12-year-old boy into a pickup truck in Santee with a phony story claiming he'd been sent by the boy's father. Plus, a court has blocked a predator dubbed Bolder Than Most from being released into Jacumba Hot Springs here in East County, and we'll have details. East County's own Diane Jacob has been reelected as chairwoman of the county supervisors as she completes her final term. The Jacumba Hikers, a popular group that leads adventures in East County's high desert region, is on hiatus. Hear how you can help bring them back on today's show. A Border Patrol agent forced to work without pay during the shutdown has filed a federal class action lawsuit, and we'll have details. Then on Destination East County, we'll have all the top festivals and events coming up across our inland region, from hawk watching to hiking, to a murder mystery play and a concert by the rock band Kiss, and more. Hear about a California lawsuit over the Endangered Species Act in a report from Public News Service. Now, if you're looking to get in shape after all those holiday goodies, we'll have some information for you today on where you can find fitness classes at local libraries. We'll end our show by re-airing one of our Best of East County classic episodes today, Helen Ofield's interview with the late, great Gary McClintock, a famous saddle maker from Descanso, on the history of vaqueros in our region. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with a special weather bulletin. A series of storms is bringing heavy rains across San Diego County, with snow forecast at higher elevations. The National Weather Service has issued a flash flood warning for Monday and Tuesday this week, with additional wet weather on the way. Listeners, please use caution if driving on rain-slicked highways, and authorities advise that if you do come across a flooded roadway or overflowing creek, turn around, don't drown. Debris flows are also possible due to saturated grounds, especially in areas across Southern California that were recently burned by wildfires.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast. I'm Mike Clifford. Topping our news, a CNN poll published Sunday found that Trump's disapproval rating is now at 57%. That's a 5-point difference from December. The ongoing partial government shutdown began December the 22nd. The Hill notes the poll also found his approval rating is at 37%. That's roughly the same as it was last month. According to the poll, 55% of respondents said Trump is to blame for the shutdown. 32% said Democrats are mostly to blame. Another 9% said both sides are to blame. And as federal employees go into their second pay period without a paycheck, desperation to make ends meet could pose serious risk for workers in the federal prison system. Tramell Gomes has our report.
With no end in sight for the shutdown, workers are worried, including those who commute from out of state for jobs at the Federal Correctional Institution in Tallahassee. Ray Coleman is president of the American Federation of Government Employees Union Local. He's also a corrections officer at the prison and says some people serving time will use anything to their advantage, including overly stressed employees.
They'll test you. They'll definitely try to see what they can get away with, see what they can get over on, see if they can compromise a staff member because they know you aren't getting paid. And when that happens, you know, that then you have a problem.
Hundreds of thousands of workers are stranded without pay as President Donald Trump demands funding for his long-promised border wall. The Florida AFL-CIO and other labor groups are organizing a series of rallies and events around the state urging the president and Congress to reopen the government. Coleman says although they aren't getting paid, he and many others are still required to be at work or risk disciplinary actions.
And the Trump administration has taken steps to shield the Interior Department from public scrutiny by restricting public records requests allowed through the Freedom of Information Act, also known as FOIA.
The proposal would allow the agency to deny requests it deems burdensome or vague, and officials at the agency say it's necessary because FOIA requests are bogging down the department's work. Jason O'Neill with the Western Values Project calls the move an attack on open public records and transparency.
As our organization and others have found, there's been a clear link between special interests, industry interests, and the work and the rule changes that have been done at Interior under this administration.
Interior Department officials say the changes are needed because FOIA requests have increased 30% in the past 2 years. Without access to government records, O'Neill says his group would not have uncovered documents showing industry requests for changes to the Greater Sage-Grouse Management Plan to tip the scale for oil and gas producers over ranching and other interests. He says watchdog organizations such as his and the news media rely on the Freedom of Information Act when agencies aren't transparent in their decision-making. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
A group of 9 volunteer aid workers goes on trial in Tucson this week for providing humanitarian aid to immigrants at risk crossing the Arizona desert.
The 9 defendants, all volunteers with the nonprofit group No More Deaths, were charged in 2017 with misdemeanors for their activities in the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge on the U.S.-Mexico border. The group places jugs of water and other survival supplies for migrants in the refuge. Officials say hundreds of people have died in recent years making the trek across the unforgiving desert terrain. Justine Orlovsky, with No More Deaths, says providing humanitarian aid to save lives should not be a crime.
The reason that we provide aid in that corridor is because we have found and recovered numerous human remains, upwards of hundreds over the course of years. So we see that there's a need there. That means people are traveling on foot through Cabeza.
Orlovsky says No More Deaths is planning a rally outside the Federal District Court in Tucson prior to the opening of the trial on Tuesday. She says the 9 volunteers were arrested by federal officers for violations such as leaving food and water in the refuge, driving in the area without a permit, and trespassing. The U.S. Border Patrol claims the volunteers' actions are illegal and enable migrants to illegally enter the country. Mark Richardson reporting.
No More Deaths Charter states that their goal is to prevent death and suffering along the Mexico-U.S. border. The group says their volunteers have faced similar charges in the past, but none of them was convicted. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener-supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with an East County Magazine report from La Mesa. An independent investigation commissioned by the City of La Mesa has concluded that a La Mesa police officer did not violate department procedures or any laws when he twice knocked a handcuffed female student at Helix High School to the ground in January of last year. The incident, caught on video, prompted protests and a student walkout. At a council hearing this month, La Mesa's mayor, council members, and members of the public voiced frustration and at times anger at the outcome of the investigation for which the city paid over $20,000 and the many questions left unanswered. Attorney Scott Tideman presented the findings on the report prepared by Barry Ananag of BA Investigations. Ananag, a former Irvine police commander, reportedly interviewed about 20 witnesses. But neither the public nor the city council will be allowed to read that report or the statements from any of those witness interviews due to state confidentiality laws governing investigations into police misconduct, Tideman said. The independent investigator did not interview the student, Brianna Bell, who has filed a lawsuit against the city of La Mesa. Nor did the report include any details on what transpired on campus before the takedown shown on the video. The report also had zero information on whether any investigation was conducted by the school or by the Grossmont Union High School District, or the results of any such inquiries. The report did examine four allegations and found no wrongdoing on the part of the officer. Tideman told counsel that the report concluded the officer's initial and subsequent actions against the student did not violate La Mesa Police Department's use of force policy. The report also found that an allegation of racial motivation by the white officer against the African-American student was unfounded. An allegation that the officer lost his temper was also deemed unfounded. Mayor Mark Rapostathis, who is also a teacher, pressed Tideman on why the student was not interviewed. Tideman stated that repeated calls, letters, and emails to the student's mother and attorney were not returned. The mayor also pushed back on claims of confidentiality of the report given during a public meeting. "Confidential to whom?" he asked, appearing stunned when Tideman replied that the report will be provided only to La Mesa's police chief. Councilwoman Christine Alicio asked if La Mesa Police Department's use of force policy is similar to that of other police departments in the state. Tideman stated that it is similar. Councilman Bill Baber asked how the report will tie into the federal lawsuit. The city attorney replied that the information could be presented in court or become public if the plaintiff is able to obtain the report through a subpoena. Newly elected Councilwoman Akilah Weber asked, "Is there information on why the officer felt this was necessary?" Tideman fired back that he was prohibited from disclosing this information, too. Weber then said she would like to hear from La Mesa Police on the racism issue. "Is there any cultural sensitivity training?" she asked. Mayor Rapostathis wanted to know, was it necessary to call the police department instead of handling this at the school, adding, "Is the school conducting its own investigation?" Members of the public took to the podium next. Yusuf Miller, with the Council on Islamic Relations and East County Justice Coalition, railed, "This is not justice for the community. We've come all this way, we sit all this time, to hear nothing about this incident. No questions can be answered." He rattled off the names of African Americans killed or injured by police across San Diego County. "All this abuse in law enforcement," he concluded, "and we come and hear a report of absolutely nothing." Next up, La Mesa resident Jack Shue told the council there has been a failure of process. He pointed out that if you ask law enforcement to do an investigation, you don't get answers. "We should know what happened," he said, adding that there should be alternatives to force. Shue proposed that the city establish a Citizens Advisory Commission for police so that we don't have this happen again, with potentially an even more harmful outcome. Next to speak was Aramik Mika, a community activist who has been a spokesperson for the family in the past. She praised La Mesa Police Chief Walt Vasquez for being receptive in meeting with activists and suggestions for more trainings. But, she told the council, "I'm sorry you wasted our money on the report." Then she called for actions to set things right. And here's what she had to say.
"I was shaking back there because we all seen the video. And I believe in putting things in context. But there's certain things where you see it and you know it was wrong. When a young lady slammed to the ground twice while she is in handcuffs or any type of restraint, and a grown man slams a young lady to the ground, there is never an excuse for that. Obviously, we have to do something different. Chief Vasquez has made a commitment to do every type of training. He knows what trainings I've done. He knows he's been to some of the trainings, his department, and I'm asking you guys to back him up. One of the things that people do not talk about is the police bill of rights and how powerful the police union is. And so I think it is the responsibility of the city council, of the mayor, of you all that sit on those boards, to really take a look at the police bill of rights and say, just because things are legal doesn't make it right, doesn't make it moral. Just because it is not okay. We have to remember, we were legally okay to be slaves as black people. That was legal at some point. So the fact that we allow for him to come up here was, I think, disrespectful and, like Yusuf said, a waste of time. Because he did not give us any new information. There's no reason after a year that you haven't been in communication with the school who was supposed to conduct their own investigation. And when we paid 50 cents to get that investigation, there was nothing on the paperwork around the investigation that the school did. So we thought, looking in your hands, that there was going to be communication with the school and the city council to really make change and really get some type of investigation, not to talk about what Bree did or didn't do, but to talk about what your officer did.
Mayor Mark Arapostathis also voiced his frustration.
The idea that this was escalated into a police matter, I have some questions. And then just the speaker said that there was no report. They paid money for a report, and there's no report. So with questions, we were thinking that this was going to shine the light on it. So it's time that we are going to have to make some other policies.
Councilman Colin Parent observed that the issues raised by the report are a reflection on why our legislature is starting to change policies. A new state law does allow disclosure of information and use of force investigations, but only when there is a death or a serious injury, which does not appear to have occurred here. Parent said he'd like to hear at a future council hearing about police policies, and what he said appeared to be a disproportionate response to the circumstances. Councilwoman Alicio, also frustrated, said, "I guess we will need to wait for the federal lawsuit to see the report," adding that a discussion of the standards is needed. But City Attorney Glenn Sabine warned the council cannot direct the police chief, which he said would violate state law. The council can, however, provide awareness on the issue. Councilwoman Akilah Weber said she wants to hear Chief Vasquez give council a review of the department's use of force policy, adding that she also wants to hear about options for de-escalating a situation without violence, including incidents involving adolescents, mentally ill, and seniors. Councilman Baber, an attorney, suggested there may have been unrealistic expectations about just what could be disclosed in the investigation, noting that it was essentially a personnel report limited by the police officer's Bill of Rights. The high school should do its own investigation, Baber said, but added, "We can't make them." However, he observed, the judicial branch is working. He noted that in the court case, depositions and testimony can be taken from the student, witnesses, and the officer, if the case doesn't settle out of court or get dismissed. And the city, by the way, has asked for dismissal, but the court has not taken action as of our press deadline. Baber later told our reporter that if the officer followed policy, we can't punish him, but if the policy is wrong, it can be changed. Mayor Arapostathis said he wanted to hear what happened in the classroom and from the student in her own words. "We don't have the right to direct the police department," he said, citing the city manager's cautionary advice, "but the public can ask for it." Councilwoman Weber, the only African-American on the board, then proposed that the city adopt the Citizens Advisory Board on Police Matters, or an oversight council, to provide transparency, community engagement, and confidence that the police department is not merely investigating itself. The mayor instructed staff to bring back information to the council for a future public discussion on police use of force policies and also models from other cities to establish a police review board for La Mesa.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
A deluge on December 6th caused a creek along State Route 94 to overflow between the Humul Casino and the entrance to Humul Estates, causing flooding that resulted in cars trapped in up to 4 feet of rushing water and delays for other motorists forced to detour long distances with no alerts sent to media nor signs posted at highway entrances warning motorists to take alternate routes, nor even an officer directing traffic. This isn't the first time this has occurred. The area has a history of flooding at two locations, at a creek that overflows Highway 94 between the casino and Humul Estates, and at Otay Lakes Road near Pio Pico. Jan Hudlin, a member of the Potrero Planning Group, who was driving on Highway 94 during the flooding, was among those caught in the traffic nightmare. She voiced surprise that after numerous past flooding incidents, there was still apparently no plan in place for the two areas that repeatedly flood during heavy rains. "We have a pending El Nino, and this will occur again," Hedlund says. "I want to know, after so many other times this area has flooded, why Caltrans and the CHP weren't better prepared to set up their roadblock, inform the stranded traffic, and route us to safety on our way home. Was there a plan in place to handle this? And if so, who dropped the ball?" She adds, "Why hasn't funding been allocated to fix those two areas?" We contacted the California Highway Patrol, Supervisor Diane Jacobs' office, and Caltrans. CHP Public Information Officer Travis Garrow promised to forward our inquiry to the new community outreach officer, who has thus far not responded. A spokesperson for Supervisor Diane Jacobs' office referred us to Caltrans. Caltrans spokesman Ed Joyce stated in an emailed response, "Safety is Caltrans' number one priority, and Caltrans will assess conditions to determine what improvements can be made to address the condition described in that area of State Route 94. He added that Caltrans coordinates with San Diego County, the California Highway Patrol, and other state, county, and local agencies to communicate real-time information on conditions, though none of them reported those conditions to the media or public during the incident in question. During storms and other emergencies, he advises following SDC Caltrans on Twitter for updates on road conditions," and he added, "We also appreciate your East County Alert efforts in relaying traffic incidents on Twitter. You can follow East County Alerts on Twitter or sign up for our email emergency alerts at eastcountymagazine.org. Reporting for East County Magazine, from Hamul, this is John Fistier.
This is Jonathan Goetz with a health alert. San Diego's County Health and Human Services Agency is warning that pandemic H1N1 is the primary influenza virus circulating this season in San Diego and across most of the nation. That's the same strain of flu that killed an estimated 50 million people worldwide during the 1918 flu outbreak. Of 1,730 lab-confirmed influenza cases reported so far this season in San Diego, nearly 94% are influenza A. Influenza A has several subtypes, including pandemic H1N1 and H3N2. During a typical year, the primary influenza virus is H3N2, or seasonal flu. But this season, there are 10 cases of pandemic H1N1 for every case of H3N2. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, has reported that pandemic H1N1 is the main influenza virus making Americans sick across the nation. An unusual feature of this flu strain is that locally and nationally, it's affecting adolescents, teens, and young to middle-aged adults more than other age groups. The CDC has investigated why H1N1 virus sickens more young people compared to children and older adults, who are typically hit hardest by other flu strains. Two factors seem to play a part. Young and middle-aged adults have not been exposed to the H1N1 virus as much as older adults who lived through outbreaks in the 1950s, and young people typically have the lowest vaccination rates in the nation. So far, 9 people have died locally this flu season. The best protection is to get vaccinated, health officials advise. The current flu vaccine offers protection against pandemic H1N1, influenza H3N2, and 2 strains of influenza B. The CDC recommends that everyone aged 6 months and older get a flu shot every year. The vaccine takes 2 weeks for immunity to develop. Vaccination is especially important for people who are at high risk of developing serious complications from the flu, including pregnant women, people with chronic medical conditions such as asthma or diabetes, and caretakers. In addition to getting vaccinated, people should also wash hands frequently, and if you're sick, stay home to avoid infecting others. The flu vaccine is available at doctors' offices, community clinics, and retail pharmacies. If you don't have medical insurance, you can go to a county public health center to get vaccinated. For a list of locations, visit sdiz.org or call 211.
The state of California would invest hundreds of millions of dollars to improve access to health care and health insurance under Governor Gavin Newsom's first budget, released on Thursday. The budget includes $200 million to allow undocumented low-income adults ages 18 to 26 to access Medi-Cal. Previously, only undocumented children have been included. Anthony Wright with the nonprofit Health Access California thinks it's a good step toward universal coverage.
This budget recognizes that our healthcare system is stronger when everybody is included. I think the big debate over the next several months is how far down that path that we want to go.
Conservative critics warn that the state's generous health benefits could attract more undocumented immigrants, but Wright says studies show otherwise. Newsom's budget proposal would also reinstate the individual mandate that requires people to have health insurance. It uses the fees from the mandate to increase subsidies on covered California plans for middle-income families, those with incomes between 250 and 600% of the federal poverty level. Wright says in the future, he'd like to see the state remove what's known as the senior penalty that hurts lower-income people on Medicare.
It's what people would call a dual-eligible, people who are seniors and people with disabilities who are underneath 138% of poverty level. They should qualify for Medi-Cal, which then provides additional supplemental coverage to Medicare, which has very high cost sharing.
The budget projects a surplus of more than $20 billion and puts a big chunk toward education and health and human services, while putting $1.36 billion toward reserves, unfunded liabilities, and debt. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Green Scene Report. Two vital sites run by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that scientists rely upon for up-to-date climate change data from satellites have gone dark, apparently due to the government shutdown caused by the impasse between President Donald Trump and Congress over a federal budget. East County Magazine climate writer Roger Kopic discovered the loss of data. He states, "We've all been expecting it for almost 2 years. Trump has finally shut down the distribution climate data." Two websites on global surface temperature anomalies now both redirect to a message that states the sites are not available due to a lapse in appropriations. The shutdown has also grounded U.S. government scientists from attending a major international climate science conference. Trump has long stated that he does not believe climate change is real or man-made, despite 97% of the world's climate scientists agreeing that climate change is a serious problem and that man's activities are a primary catalyst to the rapidly accelerating climate change that poses threats to people around the world.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight.
This is John Fistier with an Arts and Music Report. Mission Trails Regional Park has discontinued its free bi-monthly Sunday afternoon concert series, which has run for 7 years, despite near-capacity audiences for music ranging from indigenous to classical to jazz, the Mission Times Courier reports. The decision to end the concerts was made following the retirement of Jay Wilson, head of the Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation, who established the popular concert series. Fortunately, musicians have found a new home in the Mission Trails Church on Zion Avenue in San Diego nearby, where concerts will continue in a larger space with more parking. Concerts are open to all, with any donations going directly to the musicians. The concerts will be held from 3 to 4 p.m. on the second Sunday of each month. Future performers in the lineup include Yoko Maruyama, Quartet Luminoso, the San Diego Harp Society, Paul Combs, Melanie Grinnell, and Peter Sprague. A full list of upcoming concerts can be found on Facebook at the Second Sunday Community Concerts page.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat Bulletin. The Sheriff's Department is asking for public help to find a man who tried to lure a 12-year-old boy into a pickup truck in Santee on Thursday, January 10th. The boy was walking home from Rio Seco School when the suspect pulled up next to him and falsely claimed the boy's father had asked him to pick him up. The suspect told the boy to get into the truck, but instead, the boy ran to a nearby apartment complex. The suspect is described as a white man in his 40s with short blonde hair and a stubbled face, wearing a brown Hurley baseball cap and short-sleeved white and blue plaid shirt. He was driving a dirty, newer model white Ford F-150 pickup truck with lifted rims. The boy's mother told authorities that neither she nor the boy's father had asked anyone to pick up their son. If you have any information on this driver, or if you see this vehicle, please call the Santee Sheriff's Station or dial 911.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Crime Beat Report. Disturbing results of a new mental health evaluation have halted the state's plan to release sexually violent predator Alvin Quarles into the Hakumba Hot Springs community in San Diego's East County. Known as the bolder-than-most rapist, Quarles was diagnosed in October with sexual sadism disorder, voyeuristic disorder, and antisocial personality disorder, according to the district attorney's office. He was convicted of sexually assaulting four women at knife point back in 1989, in some cases forcing partners to watch. After serving about half of his 50-year sentence in state prison, he was slated for parole in 2013, but was then committed to a mental institution. A few months ago, state authorities deemed him fit for release to a home on Desert Ranch Road in Hakumba Hot Springs under a supervised program. That proposal drew outraged protests from visitors and victims of Corliss, as well as Supervisor Diane Jacob. The district attorney's office urged the judge to reconsider his decision to release Corliss as proposed. Corliss underwent a new mental health evaluation, which remains under seal. But Deputy District Attorney Jessica Cotto stated, the DA's office does believe that the info in that report provides strong evidence for the court to reconsider his ruling to release Mr. Corliss. So Judge David Gill ruled that Corliss must remain in a state mental hospital at least until a future hearing, which has not yet been scheduled. Supervisor Diane Jacob, who has fought to stop Corliss's release into the rural East County, praised the decision, stating, "That's the right thing to do. Keep this guy locked up. Locked up for good. That's what I hope."
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
Supervisor Diane Jacob has been unanimously voted chairwoman of the San Diego County Board of Supervisors for 2019. The board also named Supervisor Greg Cox to serve as vice chairman, and newly elected Supervisor Jim Desmond as chairman pro tem. Jacob, whose district includes most of East County, accepted the gavel from Supervisor Christine Gaspar, who served as chairwoman in 2018. Gaspar outlined several accomplishments in the past year, including an expanded substance abuse treatment program and adding additional cameras to a fire detection network that can provide real-time data for firefighters. As a new chairwoman, Jacob will outline the county's 2019 goals at the annual State of the County address on February 16th. This will be Jacob's seventh and final time serving as chair of the Board of Supervisors. She joined the board in 1993 and will step down due to term limits in 2020. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
The Hakumba Hikers has long organized popular hikes in desert areas of eastern San Diego County and neighboring Imperial County. These have included hikes for all ability levels from beginners to advanced, including treks to rugged mountaintops and scenic vistas, to sites where participants can view historical sites, geographical oddities such as wind caves, engineering marvels such as the Great Trestle over Carrizo Gorge, and Native American pictographs. But now, the group has discontinued its hikes until it can find new hiking leaders. One longtime leader, Richard Alcorn, recently passed away. Greg Curran, one of the remaining hiking leaders, posted on the group's Facebook page that despite a shout-out requesting more hike leaders to step forward, so far only one has volunteered, and at the last hike leaders meeting, only a few showed up, the same people who have been leading 2 to 3 hikes each month for years and are now burned out, Curran says. If you are interested in becoming a hiking leader with the Kakumba Hikers, you can contact Greg Curran at sbcglobal.net. That's Greg Curran, C-U-R-R-A-N, at sbcglobal.net. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
A San Diego Border Patrol agent is suing the federal government for being forced to work without pay since the government shutdown began on December 22nd, the Times of San Diego reports. While some of the federal employees are furloughed or off work, others in critical jobs, such as those related to national security, have been required to stay on the job. Albert Vieira is the named plaintiff in a class action suit representing 150,000 accepted employees who are being forced to work without pay at 33 federal agencies and departments. He has been working 6 days a week since the shutdown began. The suit, filed in the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, contends that the Trump administration is violating the Fair Labor Standards Act by making employees work without pay on their regularly scheduled paydays. Tony Reardon, president of the National Treasury Employees Union, or NTEU, states, "It is unconscionable that many employees are having to work, and in some cases overtime, with no pay whatsoever. These civil servants took an oath to the Constitution, and they do not deserve to be treated this way," he adds. Other agencies represented by the NTEU, which are affected by the lapse in appropriations, include the IRS, Environmental Protection Agency, Federal Communications Commission, Food and Drug Administration, Federal Election Commission, National Park Service, Patent and Trademark Office, Securities and Exchange Commission, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And I'm Jonathan Getz.
This week's Destination East County includes Hawk Watch in Ramona, an Agatha Christie whodunit presented by Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa, desert hikes and bike rides, bluegrass jams, garden classes, and more.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including bluegrass music at the Alpine Library, songs for the New World at the Encore Theater in Spring Valley, and the rock band Kiss live at Gayhouse Arena at San Diego State University.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
The Wildlife Research Center in Ramona will present Hawk Watch each Saturday in January and February. This year, the event will be held at Beechent Ranch in Ramona. Arrive at 9:30 a.m. for coffee and donuts before the program begins at 10 a.m. You will meet birds of prey up close in the Ramona grasslands. Charles Gale Band of Wild Wings, his apprentice Spencer, and fellow falconer Cisco will bring their amazing birds of prey to share with the public. Binoculars, a folding chair, and a jacket are recommended. For details, you can visit wildlife-research.org/hawkwatch.
Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa presents And Then There Were None, based on Agatha Christie's classic murder mystery novel. The play will be presented Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays from January 11th through February 10th. In this classic whodunit, 10 strangers are invited to an island by a mysterious absent host. When people start to get killed one by one, they discover that they are stranded indefinitely. Is one of the guests a killer? The survivors must solve the crimes to stay alive. You can buy tickets or find details at lamplighterslamesa.com.
Winter is the season to explore our desert region. The Anza Borrego Desert Natural History Association will host several hikes in January in California's largest state park, including outings to places such as Palm Canyon and Hornblende Canyon. There's a moonlight walk, as well as bicycling and birdwatching events. For a full schedule of these and more activities, visit the Anza Borrego Desert Natural History Association at abdnha.org.
The San Diego Bluegrass Society presents Full Deck at the Library in Alpine on January 24th from 6 to 7 p.m. It's all part of the San Diego County Library's Acoustic Showcase series. For a full list of Acoustic Showcase concerts in libraries across our region, you can visit the San Diego County Library website at sdcl.org.
The San Diego Bluegrass Society sponsors a local jam session, open mic, and pickup bands every second Tuesday at the Fuddruckers in Grossmont Center in La Mesa. Open mic and pickup bands play from 6:30 to 9 p.m., plus the popular informal jamming session outside on the patio. Musicians can sign up in advance or at the event, space permitting. For more information, you can visit sandiegobluegrass.org.
The Water Conservation Garden has some fascinating classes coming up in January, including the lore of the Kumeyaay, garden yoga, and an all-about-worms composting class. You can also enjoy docent-led tours of the beautiful gardens. For more information, you can visit thegarden.org.
Young Actors Theater will present Songs for a New World, January 24th through the 27th, at the Encore Theater in Spring Valley. Songs for a New World was the first musical from Tony Award winner Jason Robert Brown. The show is a collection of powerful songs that examine life, love, and the choices that we make. The show transports the audience from the deck of a 1492 Spanish sailing ship to alleged 57 stories above Fifth Avenue in New York. The audience will meet an array of characters ranging from a young man who has determined that basketball is his ticket out of the ghetto to a woman whose dream of marrying rich nabs her the man of her dreams and a soulless marriage. You can find tickets at yatsandiego.org.
One of the best-selling rock bands of all times, Kiss, is embarking on their final tour called One Last Kiss, End of the Road World Tour. On February 7th at 7 p.m., Kiss will be performing at the Viejas Arena at San Diego State University. Known for their elaborate costumes and makeup, as well as songs such as Black Diamond and I Like It Loud, Kiss has sold over 100 million records worldwide. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show here on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
A new lawsuit, soon to be filed, accuses the Trump administration of failing to make important decisions on the fates of dozens of species, including two in California, the tricolored blackbird and the American wolverine. On Tuesday, the Center for Biological Diversity filed a notice of intent to sue Secretary of the Interior David Bernhardt over the failure of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to make decisions on whether to list 26 species as threatened or endangered, or on whether to protect critical habitat. Noah Greenwald at the center says it's more than a case of backlogs at the agency.
They're dragging their feet, for sure. This is definite foot dragging, and it's just consistent with the Trump administration's antipathy towards environmental protections.
In response to a similar suit in 2011, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released a work plan to reduce the backlog and promised to make decisions on the tricolored blackbird and the wolverine by the end of last year. The Endangered Species Act lays out a timeline for such decisions, but the agency continues to miss deadlines. The administration has also proposed weakening the Endangered Species Act by striking language that instructs federal agencies to ignore economic impacts when making conservation decisions. The call on whether to list the tricolored blackbird is almost 3 years overdue. Greenwald notes that the bird's range extends through the central and southern California coast and the agricultural area of the Central Valley, where the birds have been targeted as pests.
They're often targeted for killing, along with red-winged blackbirds, by farmers, and they've been in steep decline and are cause for concern.
The lawsuit also asks for a decision on protecting the American wolverine, whose once sizable population in California has now dwindled down to just one known animal living in the Tahoe National Forest. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat Bulletin. The sheriff's department is asking for public help to find a man who tried to lure a 12-year-old boy into a pickup truck in Santee on Thursday, January 10th. The boy was walking home from Rio Seco School when the suspect pulled up next to him and falsely claimed the boy's father had asked him to pick him up. The suspect told the boy to get into the truck, but instead, the boy ran to a nearby apartment complex. The suspect is described as a white man in his 40s with short blonde hair and a stubbled face, wearing a brown Hurley baseball cap and short-sleeved white and blue plaid shirt. He was driving a dirty, newer model white Ford F-150 pickup truck with lifted rims. The boy's mother told authorities that neither she nor the boy's father had asked anyone to pick up their son. If you have any information on this driver, or if you see this vehicle, please call the Santee Sheriff's Station or dial 911. Next up, we're going to replay one of our Best of East County favorites, Helen Oldfield's interview with the late, great Gary McClintock, the famous saddle maker from East County, on the history of vaqueros.
This is Helen Oldfield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Back in the saddle for our next conversation is Gary McClintock, founder of McClintock Saddle Works in Descanso. Gary is famous for his beautiful custom-made saddles with their gleaming leather and hand-tooled detailing. But he is equally famous for his knowledge of the world of los vaqueros, the cowboys of the Southwest and Mexico. Gary, welcome back.
Thanks, Helen. It's really great to be back with you. I enjoy being around you. You're such a lovely, vivacious person that it always is encouraging to me.
Oh, gee willikers. Now tell me, cowboys in general have such a hold on the American psyche. For you, what is it about the story of the vaquero that is so compelling?
You know, I think where that started for me was with Granville Martin, who I came to know. I wasn't that thrilled and overwhelmed with the cowboy as a rodeo cowboy. I was more interested in the guy that rode the backcountry and handled cattle and maybe had a little small ranch. You know, what we were presented during the 50s and all the cowboy shows that were on TV, that just sounded like a great way to live. You know, that was exciting. Not necessarily the rodeo cowboy, but the ranch cowboy. That's what got my attention. And when I met Granny, he introduced me to the whole world of the California vaquero, which was a whole different way of doing things than even the Texas cowboy.
Gary, for our listeners, Granville or Granny Martin is a historian?
Yeah, he was a great historian. He didn't plan to be that way, but he just got all wrapped up in everything. First, he was a rancher, a vaquero is what he called himself. They wouldn't go, they would go vaquero and not cowboy, and he would always refer to it that way because it was a little bit different way of handling cattle and being that type of a range cowboy is what he was.
It sounds like you're referring to the vaquero as a kind of steward of the land.
That is,
that's a different
thing
altogether.
Definitely a steward of the land. You know, if you look to what an environmentalist is today, they had to be that way. They had to make the land produce for them. If the land wasn't taken care of, it wouldn't produce. Of course, you had to have rain, which is what they all pray for, to make the grass grow. But they were very essential stewards of the land that preserved the land for us to what we... Really, it's been abused, so it's not as nice as it was in their day. I mean, there's a different philosophy that's out there with the different agencies of the government as far as how the backcountry should be handled. But in his day, it was the cattlemen that were foremost survivors. I mean, it was a ranching community, a ranching society that existed with 90% of the people living out on the land, where today it's reversed. You know, it's probably 99% of the people live.
So we're talking about a whole ranching society in parts of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and spilling over the border.
Oh, yeah.
Into Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico's really where it all comes from. And that, you know, as they move north, back in the 1700s, they settled California and they settled New Mexico, they settled Arizona. And that was the only thing there was to do, is raise cattle, and you needed horses. So they raised horses as well. That was like making automobiles in that day. You had to have good horses. So along with the cattle came the good horses.
So there's a big Spanish colonial backstory.
Absolutely.
To the world of the vaqueros.
Oh, that's because, who it is.
Like, where do horses come from?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question. But they introduced the, as far back as the, when Cortez came. Cortez was the one that introduced horses in 1519. Yeah. He brought, I don't know, maybe 19 or 20 horses with him. They were in Hispaniola before that, down by Cuba, mm-hmm. and some were in Cuba. They were starting to raise them there. They were getting ready for a intrusion, an entrada into Mexico. It wasn't Mexico at the time. It became Nueva España to them,
yes.
But it was just a big land mass out there that they wanted to explore.
And those horses then multiplied, or they ran away?
No, they were very well under control. The end of breeding program came along with that. That's
okay.
Those particular, there was a breeding program in the islands down by Hispaniola. That's why they had the horses there. They were breeding them there.
Oh,
and then as they brought them over and they had the opportunity, once the conquest was done, which didn't take much, they started breeding, and some went to South America, some went to North America. So different breeding programs went throughout all of Mexico.
So it's fair to say that we have historic horses, that the vaqueros you're talking about in a contemporary sense are actually riding and herding on horses with this long pedigree.
Well, it's so mixed at this time, it's really hard to... What you say is true if you look to the Mustang. That probably has more of the Andalusian, the Lusitanos, the horses that came with the conquest. Those were the horses that propagated, and they did run loose after a while, but that was later. You know, at first, they all had to run loose because they didn't have fences. You know, they had to eat, so they let them run loose. But that's when the Indians got all the horses. They stole them from the Spanish and started their own breeding program.
Yeah.
See, they really had no horses to speak of until... Really, Father Kino came into what they called Pimeria Alta, which is the northern part of Mexico and the southern part of Arizona and New Mexico.
And Father Kino is?
Kino's the one, a Jesuit priest that introduced all that. And he had very little protection, but had a lot of livestock, a lot of cattle. And he introduced it to the Indians. He wanted them to propagate them. He wanted them to get involved with ranching. And they did.
Father Kino is a Jesuit, so he predated Father Serra,
who was
Franciscan.
Yeah, yes.
There was a kind of warfare between the two orders. If I'm recalling this correctly, Royal Spain removed the Jesuits.
Absolutely, that's exactly right.
They sent in the Franciscans.
They became very jealous of the Jesuits. Carlos III, the king over there in Spain, was thinking that the Jesuits were taking advantage of him and holding back from him taxes or gold or something. And in reality, they really were not. They had very little, and they were a very selfless people. They lived for the Indians that they were trying to convert.
Gary, you mentioned fencing, and there is that old song, "Don't Fence Me In,"
yeah.
And which is kind of the anthem,
yeah.
The national anthem for a cowboy or a vaquero. And really, in point of fact, for a modern vaquero, how much fencing is there? Is there room to be a vaquero?
You know, Helen, that's a great observation, because it's literally gone. There's very few places where you have open range. I mean, there's some of that some places, but nothing like what it was back during that era. I mean, the whole world moved on horseback. The horses were trained so well because there was so many of them to select from to begin with. After they perpetuated, especially in California, the great horse herds just multiplied. They dissolved the missions in 1835, so... About that, before that point, maybe between 1820 and 1835 was when there was such a entourage of horses grazing throughout California and the Southwest. Well, from that, they could make a good horse because they had nothing but cattle and horses. And cattle, working cattle with a young horse gives them a reason to turn, to stop, to go, to back up, to do all the different things that we require of a well-trained horse. It just came from natural working, and they were better. One horse might be better than another because of natural selection. One was just a little bit better than the other one at doing this, and as a consequence, if they could perpetuate that, they would. But they didn't necessarily ride the mares.
In the folklore of the cowboy and the vaquero, is there anything similar to the rules of the road for cars and boats where you have to give way? So say two vaqueros are meeting on a narrow trail on a mountain grade. Who gets to go first?
That's a pretty interesting question, actually. Probably not so much of a reality. Some situations would develop that way. There is some etiquette regarding the herdsman who are handling the stock, cattle, sheep, goats, whatever it is. There is kind of a rite of passage, like if you're working the right side of the herd, you don't cross in front of the guy that's working to the left of you. He shifts to the left and you go with him.
Okay.
More like a dance, you know, instead of crossing in front of each other.
Okay. And
there is that.
Is that where do-si-do comes from?
I don't know. It could be.
Are you saying that it's the tradition of the vaquero is handed down in families?
Oh, absolutely. From generation to generation. In fact, we made a video about the cowboys in Baja, and it kind of goes into a little of that and how it was from father to son. Yeah. The tradition was handed down. I mean, it was unfortunate for those who didn't have as much land. They couldn't get it handed to them like me. I wasn't in a family of that, so I kind of was left out of
that. I've seen that film, and it's 1 hour, and it's very good. How could our listeners order that, or can they order it?
Oh, sure, yeah. We have at my saddle shop there in Descanso, we always have copies available, and they can call us at the saddle shop. I mean, we're on the internet.
Yeah.
BookedTalkSaddles.com, we're there. And you can find our phone number, and everything's
right on the website, and
yeah,
then you can order right there.
It's better to call and order. I'm not set up to order off our website because I want to make it more of a personal thing.
Gary, you are terrific. Thank you so much for stopping by. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine Radio Show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617. Or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jewel, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.